Hello! Welcome to the WTF SBF episode of Slate Money, your guide to the business and finance news of what has been a completely batshit week.
Wild stuff.
Wild stuff. There was like...
Totally fucking bananas.
I am Felix Salmon of Axios. I'm here with Emily Peck of Axios.
Hello.
And we have a special guest.
Hello.
Who are you, special guest?
I'm Lizzie O'Leary, also of Slate. And I host the podcast What Next TBD.
And you and I are going to be talking on What Next TBD.
Yeah.
TBD, all about SBF, WTF.
OMG.
FDIC, CZ, FTX US, Chapter 11.
FML. All
of this stuff. It's a shit show in the world of crypto this week. So we are going to be covering the crypto shit show. We are going to be talking about Twitter, of course, because that has imploded in a shit show. Emily apologizes, but it was her idea. She's like, we do need to talk about this now.
It's true.
Are going to talk about Meta, which laid off 11,000 people, which you may not have noticed amidst all of the chaos. We have a Slate Plus about the Paul Allen art sale. And generally, it's just an awesome episode because Lizzie's on it. So keep on listening. It's all coming up on Slate Money.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
So obviously, we need to start with FTX. This has been dominating my entire week, and it is a wild story. Emily, as the kind of person who's been looking at this from afar, like what do you think the big story is here?
The big story is, yet again, everyone was fooled by a young boy genius, Sam Bankman-Fried, who graced every cover of every business magazine following in the footsteps of Elizabeth Holmes, Jeffrey Skilling, and probably a lot of other fancy scammers
probably some others who haven't fallen yet.
Yeah, he, the emperor had no clothes. SBF, as he was known, ran FTX, which is a crypto exchange, but also an investing firm called Alameda. And apparently, he used money that people trusted and put on FTX. He took it, customer money, as far as I understand it, took it off the exchange, used it for other stuff. And then when people wanted it back, it was gone.
Well, specifically what he did was he lent it to Alameda. He took roughly half, according to reports, there was roughly $16 billion that people had on the exchange. If I put on a trade, I need to put collateral on the exchange or just leave stuff on the exchange. He had roughly $16 billion of customer crypto, basically, on the exchange. He lent about half of that to Alameda, which is completely insane.
Bad. It's bad. Regulators think that's bad.
Well, if you were regulated, it would be illegal.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, he was based in the Bahamas precisely because they didn't have any regulation over that kind of thing. And so... that's just a very bad look for any exchange to lend that much money to an affiliated hedge fund. Even worse, the collateral he took for that loan was his own token, FTT, that he could just make up from thin air. And so that's an even worse look. Put those two things together, and the guy looks just way out of his depth. The weird thing is that he gave an interview last year to the Oddlots podcast, not the one everyone is talking about, where he talks about black boxes and Ponzi's.
And Matt Levine calls the whole thing a Ponzi scheme.
But the previous one, a few months earlier, he went into enormous detail about how it's incredibly dangerous for an exchange to lend a large amount of money to a single client, because that can be the end of the exchange. He knew exactly what he was doing, but what seems to have happened is that Alameda wound up needing to borrow a whole bunch of money for two big reasons. And he's like, well, there's nowhere else we can get it. We're just going to have to lend it out of FTX funds. And that was the beginning of the end.
So I have a question. If he had done this and CoinDesk had not published this article that showed kind of Alameda's balance sheet was super wonky, and begun what I think we can safely say is a bank run, right? Like, if that had not happened, would we know any of this, and would FTX be intact? Like, would it just be doing quirky
stuff? It's a super interesting question, because all of crypto is just based on faith. It is the ultimate faith-based community.
I mean, much like money itself.
But
governments are involved.
Yeah, like governments can force you to pay your taxes in their currency. And if you don't pay your taxes in their currency, they can send you to jail, right? That none of that exists in crypto. There's no actual legal need for anyone to own any crypto ever. If a Bitcoin is worth $15,000 or $20,000 or $50,000, it's only because people think it is. If they all decide we don't think there's anything there and sell it, it's going to be worth zero. There's no intrinsic value to anything in crypto. So that's the first thing, right? Like, therefore, anything that is built on crypto is inherently based on trust and faith that there is some value in here. And for a long time, there was some value in FTX. And specifically, there was a lot of value in the FTT token. And one day, there wasn't value in the FTT token. Any decent exchange should be able to survive that, because it's just an exchange, and an exchange doesn't need a lot of balance sheet. And in fact, the FTX US exchange could easily have survived that.
Because they had the reserves on hand, they had some treasuries.
Because the FTX US exchange never did this thing called rehypothecation that FTX was doing, but lending customer funds out to someone else. The FTX US exchange never even issued FTT, this exchange token. In fact, if you were in the US, there was no legal way for you to buy FTT at all. So the US exchanges, because of fear of regulators, were all actually basically fine. But FTX US was tiny in comparison to FTX, the main thing in the Bahamas. And so, yeah, basically anything in crypto, if people lose faith in it, it goes to zero.
And so, to answer Lizzie's question, though, if not for the CoinDesk piece, perhaps people wouldn't have lost faith in FTX at that moment.
So, FTX just, I don't think we've mentioned this yet, has filed for bankruptcy. Its liabilities exceed its assets. The whole thing is going to be a Delaware shit show. But the precipitating events were... There were a few precipitating events. One was that SBF got into a big fight with CZ, who's the other big whale in the crypto space.
The CEO
of Binance, which is by far the biggest exchange in crypto. Binance is like 10 times bigger than FTX. So, and CZ had a stake in FTX because he, you know, very early on had invested in FTX. And because they were having a big fight, CZ wouldn't apparently give information about his wealth to SBF, who needed it because he needed to detail all of the wealth of his shareholders in order to get various US licenses. FTX bought out CZ. He paid $2 billion for CZ's stake in FTX. And then he needed to find that $2 billion somewhere. And that was basically the first problem.
That's where the internal lending came from?
That's where some of the internal lending came from. And then the other thing he needed is he needed to borrow like $500 million because he you know, there was this company called Voyager that went bankrupt, and he kind of rescued Voyager. So he suddenly needed all of this cash. In order to get all of this cash, he wound up borrowing money and also issuing a bunch of FTT tokens, right? So a large chunk of what he paid CZ for CZ's stake in FTX was in FTT tokens.
Which is just made up money.
Which was made up money. But like everything in crypto is made up. So like, fine, whatever. But then what happens is CZ wakes up one morning, sees a report in CoinDesk saying FTT tokens are basically all owned by Alameda. And CZ's like, shit, that's not a good look. So he's like, I'm just going to sell these. And the minute he decides to sell them, everyone else is like, oh, shit. And then, as Lizzie says, you have this bank run style situation.
Yep. And then the price would have plummeted. Like, it was like the price was plummeting because CZ was selling. And blah, 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 blah.
Well, the price was plummeting because everyone was selling at
right.
that point. But then Emily had a wonderful line a bit earlier. FTX is, what do you say?
SBS. So Sam Bankman-Fried, when this starts happening, he's like, don't worry. Everyone's going to get their money. My first priority is you, the customer. And then, you know, people aren't getting their money. He's filed for bankruptcy. And I said, SBF is no FDIC. And that's why in the U.S. we don't have bank runs at regular banks. People, you put your money in a bank. It says FDIC in a little placard. And you know, whatever happens to the bank, you'll get your money back.
And more to the point, SBF is no SIPC either, right? Like when...
We don't know what that is.
When MF Global...
Yeah, Lizzie probably knows what it
is. So there are very, very, very... There are very close parallels between what happened to FTX and what happened to MF Global. Do you remember MF Global? That was John Corzine's little investment bank.
Remember. You talk about MF Global
we've been
a
through
lot.
So, we've been through so many collapses. Like, I'm like, which one is that?
I don't remember what happened.
And MF Global was brought down by basically the same thing, which was rehypothecating customer funds. And...
It's a very fancy word. What does that mean in English?
It basically means lending them out to someone else and not keeping them, you know...
You're not supposed to mess with the money.
In a lockbox, as Al Gore would put it. But the... So John Corzine or MF Global was messing around with customer funds, and that was bad and wrong. But ultimately, MF Global's investors were protected because there is SIPC insurance, which is basically the securities industry version of the FDIC.
Securities Investments
Protection Corporation. Something.
Is that why this may be too in the weeds, but is that why my 401k money is also safe? Like if Fidelity goes out of business?
Exactly.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
Yes.
Okay. So my 401k money is safe and my money is safe because it's FDIC insured. So, but if I put my money in crypto, it is not safe.
Exactly.
I mean, you could buy the dip right now.
Yeah,
but,
I mean,
you know,
well, I mean,
insane.
To be fair, and you know, I'm going to come out and say this, and it's going to come up and blow up in my face because everything is moving so fast. To be fair, it seems as though Americans with crypto are safe, and they still manage to keep their crypto. It was only the people who were dealing with like these offshore Bahamas exchanges who stand to lose a bunch of their crypto.
Because the Coinbase CEO came out in a blog post, or I was reading something where he said, when you give us your money, we put it away and we keep it for you one for one and you can get it back. Like they're not doing what a bank does, which is the bank takes your money and goes and lends it.
But it's also like lending long or you know.
So like
there has the backstop of regulation.
Right.
It's got
to keep that tier one capital on hand.
The Coinbase situation is a bit complicated because there are two different ways you can hold money at Coinbase. Mm-hmm. One is where they just custody your crypto for you. Mm-hmm. And the other one is where you have an account at Coinbase with crypto in it.
Okay.
And one of them, it is absolutely undeniably your crypto and you own it. And the other one, it is actually a Coinbase liability to you. But he is right that all of that crypto is kept in, you know, a walled off garden, as it were, you know, on your behalf. And that even if Coinbase went under, you should be able to grab it. It's just there's never been a bankruptcy where that has been tested, so we don't know for sure. But just to put things in perspective, Coinbase has roughly $100 billion worth of crypto, just people holding their crypto on Coinbase.
Okay.
FTX was not a custodian in that sense. FTX, as we said, had about $16 billion, but that was all crypto that was being traded. There was, you know, people were going long and short and yield farming and all the rest of it. The big place where people keep their crypto is Coinbase. It's probably the biggest in the world. And yeah, that's American. It's regulated. It's listed on the stock exchange. And it seems relatively safe. Obviously, the crypto can go down in value. But if you have one Bitcoin today, you'll probably have one Bitcoin tomorrow.
And do you think that fact about Coinbase keeps crypto having some kind of value? Like, even though what's happening with SBF is very destabilizing to crypto overall, there are sort of these things that put a floor in place that means crypto will still, could still, should still have value?
Well, one of the problems is that because everyone is so scared of American regulators, you know, they do things like set up separate exchanges like Binance US and FTX US and that kind of thing. And the result of that is that 95% of all of the crypto activity in the world happens offshore. It does not happen in the United States.
This is where I have a question about Sam Bankman-Fried. So Sam Bankman-Fried spent a lot of time lobbying people in Washington, testifying in front of Congress, like making friends, asking for regulation of crypto. What was he doing? Was this like an elaborate feint to, you know, play some regulatory arbitrage and say, we want the CFTC to regulate us because they won't be as intense as the SEC? Or like, what was he doing there?
This is every single crypto CEO. Like, CZ always says the same thing. If you ask him, I've interviewed him a few times, and he always says, I want clear regulation. There is literally no crypto CEO in the world who doesn't come out on a regular basis and say, we want clear regulation. Just show us the rules and write them down, and then we can follow them. But right now, there's no rules, and so we don't know what we're doing. And it's a fair point. And obviously, you know, America is where all, you know, a huge amount of money is where a huge, where very kind of, where regulators with global reach live. It's where, by the way, FTX is filing for bankruptcy, even though FTX is a Bahamas-based organization.
Yeah, so, that they, so they can get American bankruptcy protection?
They're filing for bankruptcy
like
in Delaware.
Because it's better for them? Yeah,
well also because as far, like we did a little bit of work on this at Axios on Thursday. Turns out the Bahamas doesn't actually have a bankruptcy regime. Hmm. All you can do in the Bahamas is just liquidate yourself.
So America looks great in
exactly.
that respect.
So, the entire crypto world would really quite love it if there were clear rules in America. No one can really come to any agreement on what those clear rules should look like. The crypto world wants a bunch of, like, you're special, so we're going to make special rules just for you kind of rules. While the Warren Buffetts and Jamie Dimons of the world are saying, like, why can't they just play by the same rules that the rest of us play by? It gets very complicated very quickly. But yeah, I mean, in principle, no one likes, I mean, certainly SBF didn't like the idea that Americans couldn't legally access the FTX exchange. Like, he wasn't happy about that.
But what the fundamental question I feel I must repeat Lizzie's question is, this guy was doing shady stuff and at the same time was saying, please regulate me. So you're saying, yeah, that's just what everyone says, but he wasn't saying, please catch me doing shady stuff.
Well, I mean, according to him, he didn't realize how much risk he was taking because he couldn't read his bank statements properly. And so he didn't realize how many loans he had outstanding.
What? Come on, man.
I mean, like,
he's only 30.
Okay, but if Ian Allison from CoinDesk can read your bank statements properly, you can too.
One would think. But yeah, the thing that I think you can say about Jeff Skilling, Adam Neumann, SBF, basically all of them with the possible exception of Elizabeth Holmes, is that they believed in themselves. I'm almost certain that SBF didn't think he was doing bad things when he was doing the bad things. And he did say, like, at the end, he's like, oh shit, I made a big error of judgment. Like, the big error of judgment, by the way, was quite recent when he made that big loan from FTX to Alameda, which wound up blowing up the whole company and turns out to have been, an error of judgment. You could say that when your net worth goes from $32 billion to zero. But I just think that in terms of chronology, most of what he was saying about, like, please regulate me predates the chaos of Three Arrows Capital, Voyager, buying out CZ, and all of the kind of stuff that ended up taking down FTX.
Right.
So I think I know the answer to this question, but I want to pose it anyway. So you mentioned the big banks. A lot of the big banks have been dabbling in crypto, right? They've been getting like tiny little bits of exposure. Are any of them exposed to this?
And again, this is where U.S. regulation turns out to have been amazing.
Because they're only playing around with U.S. crypto.
Well, it's not just that. They're barely even playing around with U.S. crypto. Like, the U.S. banks are so closely regulated, and their compliance officers are so cautious that the minute anyone at the U.S. bank says, we should get into crypto, the compliance officer kind of looks at them and raises an eyebrow, and they're like, yeah, never mind. So they don't. And so far as I can tell, and it's a little bit early to say this because things are moving very fast.
Yeah.
But so far, you know, this is absolutely massive in the crypto world. It is impossible to overstate how much the bankruptcy of FTX is just blown a hole. Right,
this is
in the
not Terra
of the
and Luna.
World.
This is much bigger.
Much, much bigger. This is the biggest and most consequential, you know, implosion since 2014 in the crypto world. When Mt. Gox suddenly disappeared overnight.
Oh, yeah.
But so far, I have seen basically zero real-world repercussions to this. And I think that...
Well, except for people who lost a lot of money.
Well, okay. Here's my question. Who lost money?
I tweeted and see if anyone responded.
It's an interesting question.
I don't even think any real people lost money here, right? Not directly. Like, obviously, if insofar as you own Bitcoin and Bitcoin has gone down, you know, you have less money. But... as I say, those $16 billion that was on FTX was like professional crypto hedge fund types. It wasn't normal saver folks.
It wasn't. Normal it wasn't saver someone who folks. Was like, I would like to buy 0.001 right. Bitcoins.
And if you do say that, yeah, you keep it on Coinbase. Right. And FTX wasn't out there saying like, we are going to pay 20% interest on stable coins like Coinbase, mm-hmm. like Celsius was, right? Number one, it's no Americans. But number two, like it wasn't that kind of a business. It was an exchange. It wasn't a place where people kept their money. So I don't think there are that many losers here beyond just the equity investors in SPF.
And all the effective altruism people who are being funded by him.
Yeah.
And
do they have to give back their Countryside Manor House
It's a very good question. Will McCaskill resigned from the FTX Founders
Fund. Will McCaskill,
Fund,
Oxford professor. You know, effective altruism, profit.
Have we ever talked about effective altruism?
I think
people
maybe
know
we
what
have
it is?
A bit, but like, okay. But yeah. So this is definitely bad for effective altruism because, like, it's far from clear that SBF, for all of his grand talk about effective altruism,
which is what,
which
really,
is
really well. I mean, we'll put that to one side for 1 minute. It's you know, it's like this weird kind of utilitarian, long termist. Anyway, put that to one side. He did have a fund. The fund said that it had made $160 million in commitments, which is like, I don't know, I reckon FTX spent more than that on its naming rights for Miami Sports Arena.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not even clear how many of those commitments were actually funded. So I don't think he actually gave very much money away. And yeah, so this is definitely a big black eye for this movement, which we can have a whole other conversation about at some point.
Okay. And the other losers would be I don't know how many FTX employees or Alameda employees
there
were.
Very few.
But they're all losers.
Yeah. Clearly not a lot in risk management.
No, I mean, like, that's one of
the... It's not a big department there.
There was, like, a period of 24 hours where people thought that Binance was going to buy FTX.
Mm-hmm.
And Binance has, like, 4,000 employees or whatever. And they come in to do due diligence and they realize that FTX has, like, 70 employees. And they're like... You can't do that. Like, you know, you need more employees to do all of the risk management and compliance and everything. And they wound up walking away very quickly.
Yeah, they took a quick look under the hood and were like, absolutely not.
Right. So, yeah, FTX, there were very few employees.
Which also contributed to this.
There were employees who, if you were an employee at FTX, you're a loser. If you are an equity investor in FTX, which would include the employees, but also people like Sequoia, you lose whatever you invested. But that's just the VC game.
Yeah, that actually is my favorite part of this whole story is that Sequoia had this glowing profile of SBF on their website and they took it down.
14,000 words of hagiography. It was
they just tried to pretend
thing.
It wasn't there.
But the weirdest thing.
Wayback Machine can come for you, my friends.
The weirdest thing was that apparently, this is what the information reported, SBF managed to find like $500 million to invest in Sequoia and other VCs.
Yeah.
And where that came from, I have no idea.
So this guy's broke now. He could just go home, live with his parents or something.
Well, Bloomberg still reckons he's down to his last $960 million or something.
Oh, okay.
Oh, okay. So he had some real money,
well, we
not
don't
just
know.
FTT.
We really don't know. No one has a clue. He has not. A whole bunch of different entities filed for bankruptcy on Friday. There was FTX and FTX US and Alameda. I don't know. But SBF personally did not. So we don't really know what's going on.
Will we learn any of this now that it looks like a whole bunch of federal regulators are investigating?
So apparently federal regulators have been investigating FTX US for months now. And they were worried about various shenanigans going on at FTX US, but probably not like super, super consequential ones that could bring down the entire company. But yeah, there's no doubt that now the bankruptcy is happening in the US and FTX US has filed for bankruptcy. Yeah, the U.S. regulators are going to be keeping an eye on this for sure.
I think SBF should go back, live with his parents, who I think are professors or something.
At Stanford Law, I think.
So
he can just go hang out with some VC. I mean, like, maybe he should not, actually, because that is, like, the opening chapter in the SBF comeback story. It's
well,
like he
apparently,
up and down
this is
Sand Hill Road.
One great of the novel,
weird,
honestly.
One of the weird things is that SBF's dad was working for FTX.
Come on.
Shaking my head. Just shaking my head.
This podcast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you're driving, cooking, or doing laundry, Progressive knows the podcasts you listen to go best when they're bundled with another activity, much like how their Progressive home and auto policies go best when they're bundled. Having these two policies together makes taking care of your insurance easier and could help you save, too. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. That's a whole lot of savings and protection for your favorite podcast listening activities, like going on a road trip, cooking dinner, and even hitting the gym. Yep, your home and your car are even easier to protect when you bundle your insurance together. Find your perfect combo. Get a home and car insurance quote at Progressive.com today. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
Your pet is one of a kind, and so is their journey. While every playful moment is a memory in the making, sometimes cats and dogs are a little too good at getting into trouble. That's why you should check out ASPCA Pet Health Insurance. The ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program offers customizable accident and illness plans, making it easier for pet parents like you to help your pet get the care they may need. The ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program has been around for over 18 years, and they've helped more than 600,000 pets during that time. They allow you to customize your plan, helping ensure your pet's plan is as unique as they are. Because vet bills can really add up, especially when you're least expecting it. It's simple. Use their app to submit a claim and you'll receive reimbursement for eligible vet bills directly into your bank account. To explore coverage, visit aspcapetinsurance.com/slatemoney. That's aspcapetinsurance.com/slatemoney. Again, that's aspcapetinsurance.com/slatemoney. This is a paid advertisement. Insurance is underwritten by either Independence American Insurance Company or United States Fire Insurance Company and produced by PTZ Insurance Agency Limited. The ASPCA is not an insurer and is not engaged in the business of insurance. Apple Card is the perfect cashback rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/card calculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
But we should change subject completely and talk about like a wunderkind who raised billions of dollars to create a tech company and then everything started going horribly wrong, but no one could control him because he had complete control of the company.
Yes.
How's Mark Zuckerberg doing?
I mean, he's doing better than some other boy geniuses that I know. But yeah, this week, for the first time, Facebook, which is now called Meta, which Felix won't really let us say, but we're going to say it. Meta did a did layoffs, let go of about 11,000 employees, which I think is like 13% of the company's staff. And my LinkedIn, I don't know if you guys look at LinkedIn, but I do. It's just flooded with former Meta employees saying, like, I was laid off today. Please help.
Emily is a big fan of looking at LinkedIn.
I love LinkedIn.
Never more than recently now that all of the job postings have salary ranges.
We could talk about that some other time.
That's a good law.
Well, right now LinkedIn is flooded with these former Meta employees who, I mean, those jobs were cushy jobs. According to a story that Felix shared with us, a lot of projects that Facebook started and abandoned never got rid of the staff behind the project. So a lot of people were just kind of like floating around the company, not really doing anything, kind of like that Silicon Valley, the early season of Silicon Valley where the guy works at the fake Google company and his project gets killed and he just like sits on the roof all day and like drinks big sodas and stuff. I know a lot of people that got laid off. I don't mean to disparage 11,000 people. A lot of them were doing work, real work, but Meta had done a lot of overhiring and finally kind of...
Well, they also hired, what, 30,000 people during the pandemic? Mm-hmm. They did a huge expansion over the past couple of years.
Yes.
Because it seemed like things were going gangbusters for them.
Well, I mean, this is my theory.
I mean, they were going gangbusters.
I have a very basic theory for tech industry employment, which is that when your stock is going up, and the stock market is rewarding you for hiring people and growing, you hire people and grow. And when your stock is going down and the stock market is saying that it is worried about your costs and you should fire people, then you fire people.
Yeah. And they had never had to do that before, fire people.
No.
This is like their first big layoff.
I mean, I said this before we came into the studio, but Mark Zuckerberg has got to be extremely psyched that FTX blew up this week and that Twitter is in some sort of
death spiral.
Absolutely banana spiral, because this is the third biggest story in tech. And otherwise, it would have absolutely dominated the tech news. And it's not.
Yeah. And tech, I mean, there's this site, layoffs.fyi, that I follow, and they track layoffs in tech. And this month, we're talking on November 11th, there's already been like 22,000 people laid off in tech.
Stripe, Lyft. Uh-huh.
Stripe, Lyft, Twitter, of course,
Twitter, of course, mentioned.
Yep. Redfin, which is tech, real estate. But yeah, Facebook is about half of the layoffs. And it's
and Amazon's
more...
in a hiring freeze, and I feel like...
I feel like Andy Jassy's like...
Mm-hmm.
They've been leaking stuff to the Wall Street Journal saying, like, you know, our devices unit lost $5 billion a year and we're going to have to, like... So yeah, a bunch of people are firing people. But my question for you, Lizzie, is... To what degree is the 11,000 people who got laid off at Meta this week, which is a lot of people, to what degree is that just a function of this pivot to the metaverse? Like, I feel like he is spending so much money on the metaverse. It is going nowhere. Everyone seems to agree that it's a complete black hole. He's never going to make a return on it. That is why... the stock imploded. Like,
yes.
Facebook's revenues have been more or less flat. Its stock is down 80%. If his stock, you know, if he hadn't done that and the stock hadn't imploded by 80%, would he have done these layoffs?
So, okay, I'm gonna say two different things. And I should admit that I'm cribbing in part from Jeff Horwitz from the Wall Street Journal, who I had a long conversation about this with. Certainly, employees think that that is what is going on. They are mad that, you know, Mark is super into VR with no legs, although I guess they got legs now.
They got fake legs.
They got fake. I mean, it's just ridiculous. Anyway, and so they think, like, he took a flyer on this crazy bet and we're all suffering for it.
Yeah.
I also think they overhired during the pandemic and he sort of took responsibility for that. And I think that they are in this moment of like, oh, is there some sort of recession, but like troubled time ahead? Are
right.
there troubled times ahead? So I think there are like these multiple factors that are coming at the same time.
Do you think that Facebook is particularly exposed to for lack of a better word, like US GDP growth? Is that a big thing for Facebook?
No, I think what's happening is that Facebook, the social media company, is actually fine. Like right. they make money, that division's doing fine, but they have kind of maxed out at US user growth, right? So they are more affected by other countries having big yikes moments than the US having big yikes moments. I mean, I think in their Facebook division, right? Like that's where they're trying to grow users. But I think they have obviously taken some big expensive bets on stuff that they have said we don't expect to pay off in the near term. We expect it to maybe pay off in a decade. But investors are like, no, we would like our money now. Thank you very much.
Nothing they've done has been a success. Like Facebook is a success. Everything that's successful, they own.
Instagram is a success. But everything else is something they
acquired.
Those
are acquisition.
Well,
right?
I mean, Instagram was an acquisition.
Right. Yeah. I'm saying their only successful things are acquisitions.
The only product that Mark Zuckerberg made that was a success really is Stories, which was copied from Snapchat.
Yeah. And Reels is a TikTok clone.
Yeah, but Reels isn't actually successful.
No, Reels is where people like me, middle-aged moms, see TikToks that were cool 2 weeks ago.
Yeah.
Do you see ads on Reels?
I can't remember.
But I feel like TikTok, I can't think about anything other than my hackers. I feel like TikTok has done a pretty good job of getting a fuck ton of ad revenue.
Yeah. Yes.
And that Reels kind of hasn't. Even though Instagram is just this advertising giant, it's where everyone wants to advertise. And
apparently Elon Musk buys stuff on Instagram, as he told us.
And we should probably just mention, you know, that there's this massive sound of like the entire ad world leaving Twitter en masse, and they're probably going to want to just take that to Facebook.
But the other thing that is happening, and I should mention this, and this is again something that Jeff and I talked about, a lot has changed in the online ad world since Apple started putting in app tracking transparency. So Apple pulled the rug out of online advertising, and that's how Facebook made a lot of its money.
So Apple made this big change about user tracking. Mm-hmm. Every single online media company said, this is going to be terrible, don't do this. And there was this huge parade of horribles. It's all going to be bad for us. It's going to be bad for the entire industry. It happened, and it turned out to be basically a complete nothing burger for everyone except for Facebook. Yep. Facebook, for whatever reason, and literally no one understands this, Facebook was hurt really, really hard by it. Why Facebook was incapable of dealing with it when everyone else seemed to deal with it fine, no one understands.
So I think actually an interesting thing to do, and in the future, here's a good story for you guys, is to compare what happened to Facebook and Google when this change happened, right? Because those two together are what, half of the online ad market?
More,
like 2/3? I mean, it's something absurd. And so they were both hugely dependent on online advertising. And then kind of what did this change do to each company? I don't know. Maybe Facebook just...
Yeah, no, we do know.
Google
kind of blinked and said and shrugged and went on with its life, and its revenues were barely affected. Facebook got really hurt.
So wait, just to back up, as if I'm remembering this, because I remember talking about it with Stacey. Basically, this is the feature on my iPhone where it says, do you want to be tracked by Facebook, Google, whatever?
Right. When you are not on our app.
It's like, pretty obvious. It's not obvious, but I would think everybody hates Facebook, so they say no. And for Google, they're like, oh, it's fine. I'm on Google Maps.
No, it's not that. The point is that everyone just says no to everything.
Oh, everyone says no to everything, and yet
Google still manages to sell ads despite that, and Facebook doesn't.
Oh, that is quite a puzzle.
Yeah.
We should figure it out. We'll be right back.
Hello, I'm Imi Harper. On the Slow Newscast from Tortoise, I tell the story of how a Hong Kong billionaire was silenced.
I got bombs thrown into my house. I got people came here, ransacked my computer. And I got people fractured me. I got this and that, but I'm safe.
And what it reveals about the freedoms Hong Kong no longer enjoys. Listen to Hong Kong's Rebel Billionaire on the Slow Newscast, wherever you get your podcasts.
Okay, so we're going to talk about Elon and fake brands.
Fine.
I mean, it was your idea, Emily.
Yeah, because listen, it was all theoretical before. The 80 other times we talked about Elon Musk buying Twitter. It was like theoretical deal talk and we talked about like the bankers and the loans and the money. And like, I'll be honest, like I didn't care that much and I was annoyed by it. But now it's affecting me, Felix, and I'm upset. Like, Twitter is a mess. This week has been a mess. Twitter, every day, every minute, Elon Musk is saying something that contradicts what he said, you know, the hour before, and it's a total mess. He fired half of the Twitter staff. Then he said, oops, we fired some people that probably should come back. All the people who worked on security for the site, which is really important because Twitter, I mean, you just tap it and it's a mess and the spam and the scammers come running. The people who handle security are gone. The people who work with advertisers are gone. Advertisers are gone. When I look at my feed, it's all like the weirdest ads I've ever seen. It's like looking at, I don't know, some like sixth-rate news site or something. And then he tried to sell blue check verification for $8.
Without verifying who they were.
And obviously that's all going to be a mess. And it was quickly a mess. As Lizzie was saying, a bunch of people are pretended to be companies. They bought the $8 check.
They're
and they're
so
like,
funny.
I'm Eli Lilly and
insulin is free. I have been... Oh, just
so wait. So
I've
then,
been losing my mind at the fake brand treats. Like, so, we have overthrown the government of Brazil.
There's like the fake George W. Bush account. The fake
a second Tesla has hit the World Trade Center.
Oh my God!
From Tesla Real, they also had a fake Pope. I mean,
a fake Jesus.
Oh, a fake Pepsi that just tweeted Coke is better.
And so, yeah, so this was...
Felicity owned slaves by American Girl.
So then they quickly had to be like, okay, well, we'll sell the check marks, but then we'll put a little official on the real blue verified check marks. And you're like, guys, that was what the check... Anyway, you're okay? You're going to do that?
That
okay.
lasted, what, 6 hours?
Like, I had a conversation with Senator Chris Murphy, and he was like, so I had one check mark, and then another one, and then that one went away. And he was like, I don't know. Dude's a senator. Come on.
He really is messing it up.
And then the biggest piece of all is that the entire like legal and compliance team quit en masse the day before they had to certify that Twitter was in compliance with its FTC consent decree, because it clearly isn't. If you read the FTC consent decree, it is absolutely obvious that, like, if you roll out a new product, you need to have done all of this work on making sure that it's safe and blah, blah, blah. And Elon, of course, being Elon, has done none of that. There's quotes from his lawyer basically saying, Elon isn't scared of the SEC and he builds rockets. He's not scared of the FTC. The FTC, meanwhile, is tweeting out, excuse me, we are watching this very carefully and we take this stuff very clearly, very, very seriously, and no one is above the law. And the difference between the FTC and the SEC is that the FTC can send you to jail.
Really?
Yes. Mm.
That seems,
I pray for
you know,
that.
Significant. Can I just say, this is like one of my favorites. This is actually Elon Musk. Really for real, Elon Musk.
How many check marks does he have?
Sure?
Going forward, accounts engaged in parody must include parody in their name, just not in bio. And somebody tweeted like, surreal substitute teacher losing control of class vibe. Just like everything. I'm sorry.
Well, because,
like, lots of people have lost their jobs.
Yeah.
People have lost a way to communicate. Like, dissidents in Saudi Arabia, I am worried about because the Saudis now have the second largest stake in Twitter. But like the dunking is hilarious.
Yeah, so basically Kathy Griffin and Manu Saadia of, you know, Friend of the Pod and all of these people changed their name to Elon Musk and then got banned because but another thing which just like, you know, this has been the mother of all shit shows, but one of the other things that happened along the way was that there was a report that anyone who invested more than $250 million in Twitter, which would include the Saudi government, now gets full access to the Twitter fire hose, which is every single thing that everyone
that
has ever tweeted.
Real bad. Tweeted,
which seems really bad.
I mean, that's what I was talking to Chris Murphy about, because he's like, this should have a CFIUS review.
Should I delete my account?
Should I delete all my direct
messages? Because I've done like reporting on Twitter, you know.
Yeah, probably the Saudis can see that.
I don't think it matters. I think they know anyway, right? Like, I don't think tweeting your... deleting your DMs is going to make a difference.
Or deleting my account either. It's all there.
No,
forever.
It's there.
Is Twitter... Look, is he breaking it permanently? That's my question.
I don't know.
So
If it goes into bankruptcy, will some lovely person buy it?
So, like, there is a plan. My friend Rick Webb has this idea that what he wants to do is just, someone should just buy Twitter for, like, a dollar. Put him in charge, and he's going to be like, I am not going to grow revenues. I am not going to do anything. I am just going to shore up the infrastructure. Make sure that it works. Make sure that it's safe.
With what
make
money?
Sure that you're in compliance. Twitter has $4 billion in the bank.
In cash?
In cash.
So what's Elon doing going out charging people $8 a pop? I think they rolled that back.
Elon keeps on talking about how... in the last hour. You know, Elon keeps on talking about negative cash flows and how it's losing $4 million a day or something. If you're losing $4 million a day, it still takes a while to get through $4 billion. But more to the point, Twitter only has negative cash flows because he loaded it up with, you know, $13 billion of debt.
Right. They have like $1 billion in debt service a year.
So if you do a debt for equity swap and then like turn all that debt into equity in like new Twitter, put like a very boring CEO in charge who's not trying to grow it, not trying to turn it into, you know, the biggest company in the world or a super app or a banking app or a savings account app, whatever it is that Elon wants, and just tries to make it into a Twitter that works. And then... in a couple years' time, when you have a Twitter that works, then you start building on that?
Like, I volunteer to be CEO.
Exactly.
I don't know anything about running a company, but you know what? I could do a better job.
Literally,
I wouldn't be tweeting through it.
Literally.
Which seems to be bad.
Yeah, literally, you could have a bag of flour as CEO and would do a better job than Elon Musk.
Although he claims that traffic is up to Twitter because everyone wants to watch the car crash.
Everyone's just like, refresh, refresh, refresh.
I think, I'm just putting it out there, that the government should take control of Twitter and it should be like NPR or PBS or something.
Okay, hold on.
Yeah, and then you put that.
Don't ruin NPR for me, please.
Okay, big timeout. The government has 1 cent on the dollar. I believe this is a correct, I might be getting that wrong, but it's like a tiny, 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 tiny amount of money that they put into NPR. I just want to dispel the notion that it
thank
is
you.
Owned by the
government.
As a former NPR employee and a former Minnesota Public Radio employee,
but it should be
very important to note.
But Emily says NPR. She just meant BBC, didn't you? That's what you meant.
BBC. I want it to be a nonprofit, the government.
It could be a nonprofit, but it's not owned by the government.
Okay.
Just to be clear.
So, Someone needs to step in.
Because I think that's a myth.
Emily said owned by the government. And my original, this is on the Axios Slack. And she's like, it should just be owned by the government. And I was like, which government? I vote for Belgium. And Emily's like, why? What, you know? And so I'm like, but clearly you don't want the American government in charge because the American government is a shit show. The Belgian government barely exists. This is why you want the Belgian government to do it, because like it's basically the government equivalent of a bag of flour.
Listen to me. We just had a whole segment.
Of friends in
Belgium. We just had a whole segment, Felix, in which you explained why people in the U.S. were firewalled from the horror of the FTX shit show because of the government regulation at play. So to say the U.S. government is a shit show is inaccurate, purely based on what you told us nary 10 minutes ago.
Well, no, the reason... Nary. The reason why everyone in the U.S. was protected from the crypto implosion was not because the government knows what it's doing, but because the government doesn't know what it's doing. And everyone, it's acting like a complete chaos monkey and suing people who try to follow the rules and not suing people who don't try to follow the rules. And everyone's just like trying to stay well away and just keep their head down and do absolutely nothing that could be remotely interesting. And that's why they do everything offshore. So like, that's not like sensible regulation. That's just being completely batshit.
I don't know. I think Twitter should be owned by either a nonprofit entity or the government.
Or Belgium.
Of Belgium.
Me. It should be owned by me.
Or Lizzie.
Let's just give it to Lizzie.
Although, I don't know. I feel like being a CEO, Lizzie, could turn you into some megalomaniac.
No, because I promise to surround myself with people who tell me I'm being a dumb.
So you'll hire Felix then? I think seriously.
Yeah. I would hire my husband who'd be like, can you practice the breathing that we teach our toddler? You're being impatient right now. Let's all take a deep breath.
I do think, you know, in some glorious ideal world, it would just wind up getting given to like the Wikimedia Foundation or
Fine.
Something like that.
Great.
But, and then Twitter would ask you for $5 every time you opened
exactly.
the app.
Exactly. And that would be fine. Yeah.
It'd be like, please, please give us the money.
I mean, that's what Twitter was for a while when Elon was asking us for $8.
That's true.
So let's go.
Let's go. All right, let's do a numbers round. Okay. Lizzie,
did you bring
we have a numbers round every week on Slate Money.
I am prepared for that.
Pick a number, any number, and just tell us what that number is. I will give you a minute. I'm going to start with Emily.
Okay. I have this number, and it's silly. And last night I was telling my husband the number, and then he was like, why is this interesting? And I was like, I'm not sure. But I'm just going to go with it.
Okay.
The number is 40. And that is the number of rotisserie chickens that a man named Alexander Tominski ate over a 40-day period in Philadelphia.
Per day?
One rotisserie chicken per day.
Okay.
For reasons of, I don't know, to entertain people purely.
Because it's Philly, I think, is the answer that you're looking for.
Yeah, and he's called the Philadelphia Chicken Man. And, originally he was going to eat the chicken for only 30 days, but then a miracle happened and the chicken lasted for 40 days. I don't know. I'm just making that up. And he extended it, and now he doesn't want to eat rotisserie chicken ever again. And I just want to say that I think rotisserie chicken is like one of the marvels of modern capitalism and grocery stores, but that, again, my husband was still like, why is this interesting? And I'm like, but it's great. Rotisserie chicken. That's all I have.
Okay, so I love the economics of rotisserie chicken are absolutely fascinating because, as we all know, a rotisserie chicken, which is cooked and has a bunch of labor in it, costs less than a raw chicken that is uncooked and has much less labor in it. And so everyone's like, how? Yeah. And
my head exploding.
And you get the
I'm
same thing.
I'm not sure that's true at Union Market.
Yeah, I'm almost positive it is true at Union Market.
It's always true.
Having had both at Union Market. The equivalent to that is the Grand Central Oyster Bar, where six oysters Rockefeller cost less than six oysters.
Okay, because so those were like the questionable oysters. But they decided to cook them.
But that's the same as the chicken. They take the chicken that's about to go off.
They do?
And they turn it into rotisserie.
Are you sure about that?
Yeah, that's why it's cheaper.
I don't want to. No, oh. Felix, you're ruining it. Oh, I thought it was Felix. Cheaper because it was like a loss leader, like for a Costco. That's why they never raise the price of their chicken.
No, it's because it's a way of using up the chickens that you would otherwise need to throw away because.
Are you sure?
Yes.
They're always smaller.
You're not
too.
Just making this up.
I am not making this up.
But can we also say that the rotisserie chicken is more delicious than the chicken you make at home nine times out of ten?
You can
That's
totally
an
say
acknowledged
that.
Fact,
yes.
right?
Yeah.
I got to put in a plug for Samin Nosrat's. Butter,
oh yeah, I
brine.
Do that.
That thing is amazing.
But I
made I
don't
that
know.
One. It was good.
I don't know rotisserie. Anyway, that's my number.
Okay.
Do you got one now?
Now I have. I got one.
You got one.
My number is one, as in the 1st of October, because my household has been sick since then. And this actually has a story, like a news story attached to it, which is this kind of staggering. Explosion in illnesses among young children right now.
Is this RSV or whatever it's called?
Yep. Respiratory syncytial virus. We did not have RSV, although I know a couple people, Bess Levin from Vanity Fair, her daughter had RSV. She came on my show to talk about it. RSV sucks. Colds, enterovirus, rhinovirus, obviously COVID, the flu. So there's this huge surge because there were all these kids who did not have, like, you know, regular old normal interactions the past 2 years. And now they're doing that. And we've dropped all our COVID protections. And they're all sick.
It's the new not normal.
All sick. I have been sick since October 1st.
I don't know if I should have come in today to see you.
Sorry, man. I mean, I'm not really sick anymore. Now I just have, like, a sort of what sounds like a smoker's cough.
Okay. All right. Cool.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah,
so some people calling it the triple demic.
No, it's
triple demic.
And hospitals are like hugely pediatric ERs, pediatric urgent cares are like hugely overwhelmed.
Yeah, and it is a kind of COVID rebound, right? Yeah, I think I'm going to tease the Slate Plus. My number is 6.2%, which is the average. Compound annual growth rate that you saw on the paintings that Paul Allen sold that he had bought previously at auction.
Some beautiful paintings.
There were some amazing paintings, and we're going to talk about these paintings on Slate Plus, and it was an amazing sale, which got like $1.6 billion. And we'll talk about this on Slate Plus, but like, what's super fascinating is this guy was an amazing art collector. He had the best art in the world. He managed, Christie's managed to pull together this incredible sale. Everyone came to it. Everyone overpaid. And even after all of that, at the best possible time to sell, he still underperformed the stock market. So do not listen to anyone who tells you that art can outperform stocks. That's my lesson there.
Well, we'll talk about it more in the Plus.
We'll talk about it more in the Plus.
I have questions about that.
For the rest of us, you know, we plebs who don't subscribe to Slate Plus, I think that's it for Slate Money this week. Lizzie, you came on at incredibly short notice. You are amazing. We love you. Thank
now
you for coming
on. Now come on my podcast.
Now
Felix.
I'll come on your podcast. It's a, you know, mutual podcasting society right here. Very important. Thanks to Anna Phillips for producing. And yeah, we'll be back next week with more Slate Money.